are studying the book of Exodus, and we are on Exodus 34, verse 1. I'm on page 96, so y'all are going to be right around there, 94, something like that. Now the Lord said to Moses, "Cut out for yourself two stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words that were on the former tablets which you shattered." Now, this is the story of what happens when Moses goes back up the mountain. Remember, he had been up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights, and God had given him the Ten Commandments and all of the other rules and regs that we talked about, remember? And that after he came down, he had this experience with God where God showed him himself in a way, and he came down the mountain, he heard the revelry going on from all of the pagan worship that was going on in the camp. He goes down to the camp and he challenges the people who weren't expecting to see him. They thought he was dead. He challenges the people, and there's a separation between the people who want to walk with God and the people who want to remain with their paganism. And this is one of those, the Levites come and join him, and there's this civil war almost that goes on, and all the people who aren't going to follow God are executed by Moses and his Levites. At God's instruction. So there's all of that happens. In the movie Ten Commandments, you have Dathan and Abiram, who's what was that actor's name who played Dirty Rant? And that was not him. Evan G. Robinson. Evan G. Robinson was Dathan, and Abiram was Shaden Heldon or something like that. His name is Hayden Sheldon, something like that. And they had fomented up a rebellion, and then the ground opened up and swallowed them, which is actually Dathan's revolt, which happens a number of chapters later. But what's his name? D.W. Cecil B. DeMille. That's that guy. Yeah, he conflated all that to put it together in one, which was fine. But so after that it all happened and everything cleared up and people were suitably chastised and whatever, then Moses has to go back up the mountain to get more tablets. So he probably had a big headache, so he needed a couple of tablets. So at any rate, this Exodus 34 is where that happens. He's gone back up the mountain now. So the Lord said, "Cut out yourself two stone tablets like the former ones, and I will write on the tablets the words which were on the former ones which you shattered. So be ready by morning and come up on the morning to Mount Sinai and present yourself there to me on the top of the mountain, and no man is to come up with you, nor let any man be seen anywhere on the mountain, even the flocks and the herds may not graze in front of the mountain, So he cut out two stone tablets like the former ones. Moses rose up early in the morning and went up to Mount Sinai as the Lord had commanded him, and he took two stone tablets in his hand. And the Lord descended in the cloud and there and stood there with him as he called upon the name of the Lord." So as God sometimes did in the tent of meeting, when he went up on the mountain, the Shekinah cloud would come down and cover the top of the mountain and they would have their meeting. You notice God told Moses to cut the tablets out this time. Then the Lord passed by in front of him and proclaimed, the Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in mercy and truth, who keeps loving kindness." And the word loving kindness in the Bible is best translated mercy in our language. "Who keeps loving kindness or mercy for thousands, and who forgives iniquity and transgression and sin. Yet he will by no means leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquities of the fathers on the children and the grandchildren of the third and fourth generation." Moses made haste to bow low before the earth in worship. And he said, "If now I have found favor in thy sight, O Lord, I pray, let the Lord go about in our midst, though the people are so obstinate, even though they are so obstinate, and do thou pardon our iniquity and our sin, and take us as thine own possession." Okay, so God describes himself as compassionate, gracious, and slow to anger, abounding in mercy, forgiving of sins and transgressions. However, God will punish the unrepentant guilty at great expense to succeeding generations. These are natural consequences of disobeying God. Moses bows low before God and humbles himself before him, and he begs God to go with them for guidance and protection, even though the people are notoriously rebellious, he asks for the covenant of Abraham to apply to them. And Friday mornings I'm studying something along these lines. I forget what it is exactly. I don't know what it is. Deuteronomy. We're studying Deuteronomy on Friday mornings. And we've been going through a whole lot of what... it's a recasting of the law, which is the law is revealed in Exodus, Numbers, and Leviticus. That's the full law is. It takes those three chapters. And Deuteronomy, which is the second reading of the law, which occurs at the River Jordan before they go in. Moses can't go in with them. Joshua leads them in. And they have this second reading, or Deuteronomos, second law, second reading of the law. There. And all of this stuff is being rehashed and sort of shortened form. And we're having a lively discussion because the we're just seeing some of the law, some of the 613 stuff revealed here. As you go through Numbers, Leviticus, Leviticus is the law for the priests, and Numbers is the law for the people. So that's kind of how you know those things. Leviticus has everything to do with the Levites. But as we're going through a recounting of these laws in a somewhat abbreviated form, it's the men are having various responses to them. But one of the things that they're beginning to see is why certain things make sense. And it talks about the fact that God was going to walk among them in the camp. Now, we can envision Jesus walking, come to our town and walking among us. And when, for instance, the people were aware that Jesus was coming and they were receiving him as the Messiah, they put palm fronds down in the streets and their blankets down over the palm fronds so that as he went through them, he didn't have to step in the sewer. Because remember, the streets were the sewer. Well, so this whole thing about putting palm fronds down and other things so that the king could pass through and not have to smell the streets, it shows a high honor, right? In other words, that's what you did when you wanted. I mean, like if you knew that somebody was coming to your house, you'd clean up. You'd run into the various levels of cleanup. And if you've got a messy husband or something like that, you make sure that his bathroom's cleaned up and all that kind of stuff. So the point is you would actually, I'm the clean, I'm the one. But anyway, she doesn't have a messy husband. Anyway, the point is, who knows? Anyway, back to the Bible. Stick with something that's true. The point is you honor people by making sure your house is vacuumed and things are dusted and there's flower smell. Maybe you've got a candle burning or whatever. In our house, we don't have fish on nights when company are coming. So we have bridge over on Thursdays. We never have fish on Thursdays because fish leaves an odor. And, if you're living in the middle of it, you don't notice it, but when you walk in, it hits you. So we only have fish on nights when no company are coming. So if I smell fish, I know that there's no company coming tonight. That's just because Nessie doesn't want our company to have to walk in and get a whiff of our old fish, you know. So anyway, that's what happened. So what was happening in when the Messiah came into Jerusalem, Palm Sunday, we call it. Well, in the Old Testament, one of the laws, and we were talking about the 613 rules and regulations, but one of the things that God had to tell them is when they wanted to relieve themselves, they needed to take a shovel, go outside the camp, dig a hole, and bury their waste. Now, that is the detail level at which he got for them. And the reason is because they wouldn't, that's not how it would have been had he not told them to do that. Because the normal habit and practice of the people was very different than that. If you're in Africa today, if you go to Swaziland, for instance, or in Kenya, some parts of Kenya, but anywhere in Swaziland, one of the things that happens is that people relieve themselves in the streets. Men, for instance, will just urinate wherever they are. And the fact the European Swazis call it the Swazi national pastime, because they're walking down the street and they'll usually stop and turn toward a wall or something, but there they go. There's not the slightest bit of hesitation, nor do they think there's anything wrong with it, nor do their women think there's anything wrong with it, because this is what they do. Janine.
Dogs know better than that.
Huh?
I mean, dogs know better than that.
No, the dogs do the same thing.
My 5-month-old puppy goes off as far as she can and then tries to cover it up.
That's because we have socialized. Well, we've tried to socialize. We've socialized animals beyond their natural things, whatever. But the well, a lot of people can train their dogs better than they train their kids, I might add. But so the point, though, is that Janine talks about the fact that, you know, she'd be walking around the streets with these little kids, and they all want to hold your hand, but then they would just stop and drop right there. And then keep right on going. So the streets are sewers. People would, have chamber pots and throw them out in the streets. The streets are sewers. You may remember as late as the early 1900s or 1800s, sort of a comical scene of you got the bill collector downstairs knocking on the door and the maids upstairs throwing the chamber pot out over on top of his head, because that's what they did. They would open up the upstairs window and throw the chamber pot out. So we're very socialized. And interestingly enough, there are people who come from other cultures that look at us and they go, "You are the crudest people. I can't believe some of the crude things you do," because their culture doesn't accept things that we accept. Like maybe popping gum or something like that, or certainly the way we wear our blouses. Or worse than that, our short shorts. If you go to Africa, at least Kenya and Swaziland were the two places I can speak with authority. If you got slacks on, you might wear a skirt around it, because in those cultures, what's erotic is anything from the waist down, including legs. Whereas what's up top is not all that much of a deal. There are ceremonies in Swaziland where the women go topless during the ceremonies, and it's not a big deal. They don't think of it as erotica. So a lot of this sort of thing is culture. The British, when we brought a bed in from England in the business, I was in medical business, in the medical business, and we had a specially medical bed that was made in England. It was an upside-down hovercraft, is really what it was, and it allowed people to lay on this bed but not lay flat on it. It sort of kept them just a smidge off the bed for pressure sores. And it's called an air bed, and we brought this thing in to distribute it in this country. But it came with no instructions for how to clean it. And when we asked the manufacturers about that, they said, "I just wipe it down with something, you know." We said, "Well, that will never pass in our culture, because there are very stringent laws about how you have to clean things in hospitals and whatever." And he said, "Yeah, you guys got a fetish with cleanliness. You're just over the top with it, you know." And so we had to create our own cleaning procedures. We had to make it up from scratch, because something that would pass muster in our country. So God is giving these people all kinds of instructions that seem, in some cases, infantile. Because, you know, you'd think, well, you shouldn't have to tell these people that. Well, we're reading our culture into their scenario. These people live in very different worlds, have very different culture. What's considered normal, ordinary, acceptable, or whatever. In their culture, we would be shocked at times. And that would be true of everybody in the world at this particular time. Remember, it was very true that even among the very rich, only the very rich bathed on a regular basis. And even among them, they used a whole lot of perfume to cover up a whole lot of BO and whatever, because it's just the way they did it. And I'll give you another example. Is if you ride on an airplane in Kenya, take a mask. The first time I rode on an airplane in Kenya, the odor was, the BO was so bad that I took my book and put it over my nose and flew the rest of the way with my book over my nose because I was rather smell the binding on the book than what was coming down the aisle. And the stewardess came down the aisle and she was dressed to the nines. I mean, the stewardesses on these little Kenyan airplanes they're dressed way up. They got these little bitty carts, things, little bitty aisles and whatever, and they're coming down, they're bringing you a biscuit, which is a cookie and a small drink about this big. And stink, I mean, just whatever. And the women think of their men as strong smelling, as being manly, you know. And so, you know, what passes for breeding in some places is different than in other places. Well, God has an opinion about what passes for good manners, and what passes for breeding, what passes for right behavior. And when he was dealing with, you're probably wondering why we've been going with all this craziness. He was dealing with a people who were living anasharal in a lot of ways, including who they could go to bed with and all manner of things, how they did church. Church for these people, for instance, was a little bit different affair. You know, everybody get liquored up, grab your temple prostitute, and let the drums beat really loud and whatever, and the horns, and it's all just get snockered and have church. That was church. So God was dealing with a people that he had to train to be godly, how to live godly. And if you think about this now, if the Lord were to come in our midst today, and the people in America were to say, we want you to help us, we want you to be our God, we're in slavery and we want you to lead us out to whatever, God would say, okay, well, I can do that, but let's tell you what passes for good behavior, okay, in my kingdom. And he'd say, well, okay, let's take off the television programs that won't be on anymore. Okay, there's three left. Everything's on the Hallmark Channel and PBS. Okay, everything else is gone. Okay, let's talk about what is news reporting. That's all very different. You see, if God came among our midst today and he were to educate us as to what passes for good behavior, our life, our culture would be very different than it is now, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? I mean, if it was in Beaver Cleaver's day, it would still be, there would be changes. It would still be changes in Beaver Cleaver's day. You know what I'm saying? So, think about this. So when the people, where we're going with this culture is back to pre-God days. When you take God out of your culture, what you wind up with is a culture that's pre-God. That's what our culture is out there. So when the Lord has brought these people together, and he's saying, okay, this is what passes for good behavior, and this is what passes for holiness. And you know, remember, holiness means to set apart. This is what passes. This is what my people, my set apart people, they live like this. And you don't hold grudges, and you don't kill each other, and you don't do this, and you don't do that. I mean, he's got this whole list of rules and regs to teach them what passes for godly living. And it's down to the bare bones of, if you have to relieve yourself, take a shovel, go outside the camp, dig a hole, and cover over your waist. Now, that's a bit of a challenge. If you got 2 million men, and their wives and children or whatever, and the camp is as far as you can see. You know, they had to go and invent the latrine. Because what would have happened before that is it would have just, it would just happen wherever it happened, but not in somebody's house or not in somebody's tent. And everybody else would have stepped around it. We think that's strange, but it isn't a whole lot different than it is today. I mean, we the people of God, need to look around at our culture and say, if God was going to reorganize this culture, what would he take out of it? And what would he put in it? And then, how much of that's in my life? I'm always surprised at how much of it's in my life when God begins to talk to me about what I should or should not do, watch, read, think, listen to, spend my time, you know, how I should react or whatever. So God says, I will come and walk in your midst. For the people to have the privilege, it says right here, for the people to have the privilege of God walking in their midst, they needed to reshape their culture so that it was not so offensive that he would be willing to walk in their midst. And, you know, you take the tabernacle and everything near the tabernacle, that had to be spotless, pristine, and the behaviors had to be... You remember the guys who were sacrificing the meat had to wear breeches because, you know, there's nothing on them kilts, right? And they could not, that was exposing themselves to the Lord, and that was unholy. So they had to wear linen breeches. All the more true when they got to building the temple and they came up the steps to do that. They were told that. You know, God tells them that. That sounds very strange to their culture, but it's important to God. And we need to let what God says shape us. So when we read these things here, we can do one of two things. We can say, that was sure weird. Or we could say, I wonder how that's supposed to inform me in my life today. I wonder how that's supposed to inform me. And one of the things that it's supposed to inform us is, you know, there may be some pieces of it that we don't have to do exactly what it's saying here because of cultural differences, or, you know, we have refrigerators now for our meat, so we don't have to, you know, consume it in the same way or whatever. But what we still need to get from it is that I am a holy God. And if you're going to live before me and have me dwell among you, then you need to be a holy people. So we talk about sanctification a lot sometimes. We talk about sanctification a lot, actually, in which we talk about asking the Holy Spirit to show us how to improve ourselves so we can become more like Jesus. It's kind of like the confessing our sins and asking the Lord to make us better people. Well, that is true. That's right. That's a very important reason for sanctification. But we've talked about at least two other reasons for sanctification. Another reason for sanctification is to stop the generational curses from coming down to our children and our grandchildren. Because if I continue to do the foolishness of my father, then my children see that as the foolishness of their father and their grandfather, and they go, well, it must be the foolishness that we do. And if you want to stop the foolishness that's in your family, you know, then one of the things that you need to do is to stop it here. At me. Let it stop at me. So that the ones, I've told you before about the fact that the Lord told me to stop smoking my 15 cigars a day because my sons were beginning to smoke and I decided I didn't like that, but I had no moral basis for telling them not to as long as I was going to give myself permission to do that. I'm not making any statement about smoking. I'm just saying that's what I felt God say. And so one of the reasons that we need to sanctify ourselves is to prevent the generational curses from coming down upon our children and our grandchildren. We all look at our culture today, and we look at our economy, and we go, what kind of world are we leaving to our children and our grandchildren? And it's one thing for a politician to get up and say, our children and grandchildren. But our children and our grandchildren, they have names. They have names. Those little towhead kids running around the place. And you have to think about what kind of world they're going to grow up in, and it won't be your world. It'll be something different and not likely to be better the way the culture is going now. Then the other reason why we need to seek sanctification is so that we create an environment where God can walk in our midst. We as a people in America, in the church in America, suffer from a very heavy malnutrition of the presence of God. If you think about this, we don't see many miracles. We don't see many startling demonstrations of who God is. What you see is godly people here, there, and yon, who inspire you to behave in certain ways, or something will happen once in a while. But, you know, we tend to think of miracles as, hey, I got a job, or I sold my house, or somebody got healed at the hospital, or whatever. But, you know, and those are fine. But those are like low-level garden variety miracles. You know, the power and presence of God in the midst of us is something else altogether different. And we as a culture and the Western church suffer from a malnutrition of the Spirit. And one of the reasons is because we have so opened our floodgates to let the world come into our church and into our lives. that it's made our environment unpleasant for the Lord to walk among us. And so he does not. I can tell you that if you're spiritually sensitive, you can walk into a home, and that home will either have about it a presence of the Lord feel, or a presence of the world feel, or someplace in between. You can walk into some homes, and it's like you've walked into Sodom and Gomorrah. You've walked into confusion. You've walked into just a total mess. There's frustration. There's chaos, whatever. And it's the spirit of the house. I remember when we used to go house hunting, you know, we've bought 18 homes, or we've moved 18 times. And but whenever we go house hunting, it was always amazing to me, because you would go from house to house, and each house would have its own feel about it. And you walk into some homes, and it's kind of like, these people don't get along here. Or, you know, the values here are not good. And you walk into other places, and there are there's a whole different feel. Now, you can walk into a very nice, expensive home, and you can go, I can feel divorce in this place. Or I can feel the chaos in this place. I can feel the argumentativeness in this place. Everything is high-end. It's all very whatever. But, you know, whatever. Or you can walk into a place that's not as rich or whatever, but the peace of God is in the place. When Nancy and I would go out looking for houses, we would, you know, when you go on these house hunting trips, you're coming from out of town, you're going to move somewhere. We did this a lot. And they show you 30 houses in 2 days or 3 days. And after a while, they all begin to run together. And so we started giving them names to help us remember which house was which house. And the house we bought in Spring Ridge, well, when the lady showed it to us, they had that big blizzard in March of 93. And we started out from San Antonio to come in for a 4-day house hunting trip. Got stopped in Dallas over the weekend and flew in on Monday morning when they reopened the Hartsfield Airport, and had a 2-day trip instead of a 4-day trip. And so we were running around town with our realtor looking at houses as fast as we could look at them. There was snow everywhere. You could barely get around. There were pine trees sticking through the roofs. And you'd go into the house, they'd say, don't pay attention to that skylight. You know, I mean, you know, it's not usually like this, you know. And all the kids were home from school. And so you'd get these little kids, you know, and they'd go, please buy our house. Bert is desperate. You know, daddy's in trouble. You know, please buy our house. You know, and the kids are going, and parents are trying to get the kids out of the way. Well, the house that we finally bought, the wife was there, and she was showing us around, and it was a lovely home. But she said, now my little boy is in the tub upstairs. And but, you know, he won't mind if you just take a quick peek in or whatever. So we went in, we looked in, and here's this little 5-year-old, 6-year-old boy or whatever, you know, floating in the tub. He's going, Mommy! You know, because here's these people looking at the bathroom real quick. And so we called it the boy in the tub house. And that's the one we, you know, that's, remember that boy in the tub house? That's, you know, that's the one we bought. But I remember we had a house called Dark Mark, because the guy who was selling, his name is Mark, and this house was so dark. It was just overbearing dark. You know, I think his lightest color was maroon, you know, or something like that. And everything was black, and it was like curtains and drapes everywhere, and it was dark in other ways as well. So environments have, they reflect things, and God is saying to these people, I want to come and walk in your midst. I want to walk among you. And so therefore, what you need to do is to clean up your environment to make it possible for me to come and walk among you. So the third reason then for sanctification is so that God might come and walk among us. But that wasn't what you thought you were going to hear all about tonight. Okay. Well, you know, one of the things that we're having this national discussion about, somebody said something about going home cleaning up. One of the things we're having this national discussion about is consumerism, and the fact that we as a people buy for sport. We shop for fun. We don't buy for what we need. We shop for fun. We buy, and we go out and we buy stuff just because we don't have one. And you know the old George Carlin thing about you got to buy a bigger house because you got too much stuff, and then the bigger house you buy has got an empty room, so you got to go out and buy more stuff. We buy things that have no apparent I mean, we buy decor, and then we buy double decor. I have somebody in our family who, if she goes into a house and she sees an organ for sale, and she thinks it's a good price, she'll buy it, even though it's not a soul in the family can play it. And so she's got this organ in her, stand-up organ. If it's a good deal, she might have two dining room sets or something, because it's a good deal. And so her house looks like a furniture store. You can't get through it, because we buy. And one of the reasons that we buy so much stuff is because we have substituted buying for being happy. We use buying as a way to... some people eat themselves and try to eat themselves into happiness, and so we become obese. But some people buy themselves into happiness, and so what happens is that we have a whole lot of people who's got junk crammed in every closet, and their basements are full of stuff, just stuff everywhere, more than they need, more than they'll ever need. I've got another family member who we love very much, and their closets have clothes in them that are from the 40s or the 50s or the 60s, and they're jammed so tight in there. I mean, they've got poles holding up the things, and it's like they're not going to wear these clothes ever again, and yet they just sort of collect them. It's like their possessions own them. And so there's this national conversation that goes on about this process. And one of the things the Lord's trying to tell us on a very practical level is that less is more. That if we would first of all take everything we don't need and get it out of our houses, we'd have more room for us, we'd have more room for our neighbor, we'd have more room for him. We would have room to be able to do a lot of things for him. And we wouldn't be owned by our stuff. If we would realize that what God wants us to have is everything we need and some left over for good works. Not everything that we've ever had and are ever going to have, or whatever. Or not everything that's advertised to us. So less is more. We would be able, for instance, to buy smaller houses. If we bought smaller houses, we would have money left over to do other things, say for missionary work, both in the country and out of the house. If we lived in less house to enable our neighbor who has no place to live to have a place to stay overnight in the cold weather, that would be a better thing. So we're having this sort of national discussion about this. We went through this phase where we were building McMansions all over town. Huge things. I remember many of us here play golf, or some of us play golf, and one of the things that you can't hardly walk around a golf course without looking at houses all over the place that are 8,900 feet, 6,500 feet, and there's two people in it. Two people live there. It's like you can say, well, maybe their kids come to visit. Their kids don't come to visit. They hate them. There's two people live there. There's no one's ever there. And they'll buy a bigger house next year because it's a symbol of something, as opposed to what do they really need. Meanwhile, we got people living under bridges and all that kind of stuff. So there's a certain false distribution of what we have that is part of the culture that we live in that prohibits God from walking among us. It prohibits God from walking among us. Just something to think about. And so God is... one of the things that's happening to us right now, we went through this thing of this building boom, and it crashed, and when it did... It became a very public demonstration that the buying and purchasing of houses is not making us happy as a country. We thought that, there was a point in time, it's like everybody's selling something, the industry's selling something, the government's selling something. Everybody should own a home. They should. It's their right? They should own a home, and a big home, a nice home, whatever. And so they created an environment where people could go out and borrow more money than they can afford, to go buy a house that's bigger than they need. I mean, when you look around, many of us here grew up in houses that were somewhere between 800 and 1,100 square feet. Three bedroom with five kids, and those things may or may not have had air conditioning. Very small yards, maybe worked a little garden in the backyard, that sort of thing. And drove a Chevy, or drove an ordinary car. And who's to say that we are happier now? We are certainly more prosperous, but who's to say that we're happier? We didn't know we were poor because we had what we needed. So, at any rate, this collapse of the housing market is not just an economic event. It's a spiritual event. And it's designed partially to show us that the gods that we raise up and lift up will not sustain us. That the gods that we lift up before us are not worthy of our bowing down to, because they let us down, and we come away empty-handed and empty-hearted because of all that. So this national discussion that's going on is going on in spite of the fact that many people don't know what's going on. But people are figuring out that consumerism is not making them happy. So, moving on, before I lose the rest of the class. Moses bows low before God, and he humbles himself before him. And he begs God to go with them for guidance and protection, even though the people are notoriously rebellious. He asks for the covenant of Abraham to apply to them. Lord, you know we're a bunch of rebellious people, but please go with us anyway. All right, verse 10. Then God said, "Behold, I'm going to make a covenant. Before all your people, I will perform miracles which have not been produced in all of the earth, nor among any of the nations, and all the people among you will live to see the working of the Lord. For it is a fearful thing that I'm going to perform with you." Now, we would say it's an awesome thing that I'm going to perform with you. I've talked many times before about the word fear in the Bible is usually means awe. Like fear of the Lord is to have a deep and abiding awe or respect for God. Not craven fear, but just the kind of awesomeness that intimidates bad behavior. You don't do things with your mothers in the room. You know, you don't do things when some dignitaries in the room or whatever. There's the language you use when the pastor's in the room, and there's the language you use at the bridge table. Okay. "Be sure to observe what I am commanding you this day. Behold, I'm going to drive out the Amorite before you, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. I'm going to take you to a land where people have McMansions. They've got all this stuff. And they have quit walking with me for the last 400 years. And all my attempts to reach them for the last 400 years have gotten me nothing. And I told your forefather Abraham 400 and some odd years ago, even longer than that actually, that one day I would give him this land, but not yet, because the sin of the Amorite was not complete. That's what I told your forefather Abraham. I will give you this land, but not yet, because the sin of the Amorite is not yet complete. In other words, they had time to repent, but they wouldn't. So after 400 years of tolerating these people, all of whom came from Noah, and therefore all of whom should have known better, of the way that they behaved toward one another, and the violence and all the perversions and whatever, he said, I'm going to take you in among them. I'm going to drive them out. Now, one of the things that people get really upset about sometimes is the way that God told the people to slaughter everybody when he went in. But you have to remember that they didn't have to be killed. They could have left. It wasn't like God said, go kill them all. If they had left, if they had been driven out, if they had left, they wouldn't be dead. So when people talk about, well, the fact, well, God's just vicious because he told them to go kill all those people. Well, if they stay, yeah. But they could have left. So,
but how would they have known that was coming?
We are all responsible to know what God's doing in our time.
Well, I mean, the Amorites, they weren't God.
They were sons of Noah. They were sons of Noah. You talk about the Margie's asking, how can these people, the Amorites, have known that, you know, whatever. There is no people in any age and any time where God has not tried to reach them or spoken to them. Their consciences bear witness as to what's going on. They see all around them that there is a God. These are all descendants of Noah, so they all knew why the flood happened. they all remember that in the time of Moses, the Midianites were still walking with God, because it was the Jethro priest of Midian that explained to Noah, to Moses, I mean, all of the things about God. He grew up in Pharaoh's courts. So many of these people, God, remember, rebukes the Moabites and the Ammonites because they failed to befriend their cousins, the Israelites. The Ammonites and the Moabites were the sons of Lot. He rebukes the Edomites, the sons of Esau, because they failed to befriend their cousins, the Israelites. These are the sons of Esau. He rebukes the Amalekites and a number of other groups because they were the sons of Ishmael. And these groups that, all of these groups that God is pushing out of here, that he's listed, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, the Amorites, these Canaanite people. These were people who lived in Canaan, that's why they're called Canaanite. They were genetically Amorites, sons of Amor. They were all descendants of Noah. And we don't have their record. The Bible, remember, is a very narrow record of what happens to a people. It's his story. It's God. It's Jesus' story from creation all the way to the end. It's his story. It's history. But it's a narrow history. Remember, when we look at the genealogies, once you get to a certain place, it stops. We don't know what prophets went to the Amorites. We don't know what prophets went to the Perizzites. We don't know what prophets God sent or who he sent to speak to the Hittites. We don't know these things. We know that all these people had a sense of who God was because they all had religions. And they all had, you know, for instance, Job. Job was a man contemporary with Abraham. He was the most righteous man in the East. Abraham was the most righteous man in the West, but Job was the most righteous man in the East. And Job lived among a people who were not Jews at all. He lived among another group of people that came from Noah, away from the land of where the people of Israel were, where Abraham himself was, actually, because people of Israel hadn't occurred yet. He's compared with Abraham. So we got Job over here, and he's in another culture altogether, and he knows God every bit as good, or maybe better than Abraham does.
In
every age and in every place, there are honest hearts who find God. Remember Brother Yun in the middle of the Chinese culture, who, there are people who say, God, if you're there, show me. In every age and in every place, there are people who say, you know, the way we live is not godly. And God, you've got to be there somewhere. Show us what's right. And those people pull themselves out. If you looked at David's army, you would find that it was full of Philistines, Amalekites, Hittites, Uriah the Hittite, for instance, and people from other cultures who had left their culture and had joined themselves to Israel because they felt like that the God of Israel was the God of truth. Why would his army be so full of these others? Now, remember that what we're told is when the people left Egypt, came out of Egypt, there were 2 million men plus women and children. But many of those people who came out of those, and in addition to that, many people from other cultures who came out with them, because they identified with the God of Israel, not with the God of their culture. You know, I mean, the you know, we got Moses being accused of marrying a Cushite woman. You know, so we are all without excuse when we stand before God, no matter where we were born or whatever. In every age, every person is capable of finding God. In the midst of every culture. And in every age, in the midst of every culture, a person is capable of abandoning God. Because you look around our culture, which we prize so highly as being Judeo-Christian, and you ask yourself, how many people have abandoned Judeo-Christian culture? You said it's irrelevant, it doesn't matter, it's not even good sense. They become evolutionists, become hedonists, they become ungodly people because God's a bad word to them. Right? I mean, lots of them. They're moving as fast as they can. And when cultures deteriorate, they don't go from being, you know, sweet as Jesus one day and you know, satanic the next. They deteriorate over time, like ours is. And if God tarries and we don't change, there will, one day in the future, someone will say, you know, those American people, they have no theology of God whatsoever. And you know, they'll probably assume we never did. You remember when we were studying the American revivals that one of the men who was the head of the New England newspapers had come through Kentucky and he said, there may have once been a godly people in this place, but not now. This was one of the comments that he made before the revival hit in 1800. He said, there may have once been a God in this place, but not now. Because everybody was into violence and pernicious behavior and just evil of all kinds. So these people that God's going to drive out from among them, they all had a fair shot. When we get to heaven, we're going to be able, if we wish to go to the Lord and say, I'd like you to give an account for the parasites. Okay? Now, you just walked in here and slaughtered these people and whatever without so much as a by your leave. So explain that to me, God. So, you know, you might want to get your cards ready of those things you want God to explain to you when you get there. I promise you that he will have a good explanation and you'll wish you never asked the question. Because he's going to go, well, you know, how much do you know about the parasites? Because I lived among the parasites for 400 years every second of the day. And I know what actually went on there every second of every day in every year. And I know about the people who walked before me there, what few there were, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we're sitting here going, he just walks in there and cleans those people out. You know, well, do we really think that we know? We really think we did? So, anyway, back to our text here. God is saying to them, I'm going to bring you to this country where people have planted vineyards, farms, they have herds, they've built nice houses, whatever. I'm going to give you houses you did not build, clothes you did not sow, vineyards you did not plant, fields you did not grow, cattle you did not breed. I'm going to give you all of this stuff. I'm going to walk you right into this. Out of the slavery of Egypt, into all of this. I'm going to do that. He said, that's part of the miracle that's going to happen here. You know, the probably most average response to all this when it happened was complaining that it wasn't good enough. He got more cattle than I did. Well, how many did you have when you got here? None, but he got more than I did. Watch yourself that you make no covenant with the inhabitants of the land into which you are going, lest it become a snare in your midst. If you sign up for fellowship and friendship with the people of the land, it's just a matter of time when you'll be just like them. Then I'd be bringing somebody else through here. And if I run out of good people, I have to bring some bad people like the Assyrians or the Babylonians. Rather, you are to tear down their altars and smash their sacred pillars and cut down their asherim. You are to destroy their culture, their godlessness. Wipe it out. If it does not relate to the culture that you and I have as a people, God says, then you need to eliminate it. Now, if you find people there who are kind, and you don't have to destroy that. If you find that they're generous, you don't have to destroy that. If you find they're faithful to their spouses, you don't have to destroy that. But anything that does not relate to the culture that I've given you, you need to eliminate it. Get it out of your midst. For you shall not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. One of God's nicknames is Jealous. I am jealous. The best way I know how to say it is, imagine how you'd feel if someone else was messing with your spouse. You're a jealous person. You want that person unto yourself. And you don't want somebody taking an inappropriate relationship with them. You know how you feel about that. Well, God is as jealous as we are. He's saying that desire to have my bride unto myself and not share her with other gods flows out of my attitude of jealousy. You know, one of the things we often fuss about is we talk about various sins, like, say, murder. You know that God cannot murder someone because God has a legal and moral right to eliminate life when he wants to because he gave it to us? So God can kill us all day long and it's not murder. You and I can't because we're not God. When we murder someone, we take in the place of God. We're deciding who should live and who shouldn't. That's only wrong because we're the ones deciding instead of God. Well, the same thing is true with jealousy. You know, I mean, we talk about jealousy as being a problem. Jealousy is a problem when it's inordinate. Andy Stanley wrote a book called It Came From Within. And he's talking about the various aspects of our life that get out of hand and become a problem. In fact, on the front of it's got this big Tyrannosaurus Rex, like this monster that come from within. And he points out that lust is not a sin, it's an appetite. And it has to be controlled. Lust is just another name for desire. And if we didn't desire food, we wouldn't eat. If we didn't desire, you know, spouses, we wouldn't have children, etc., etc. God puts desire in us. We have to manage it. Somebody says we should just eliminate it, doesn't know what they're talking about. There are people who do that. They're called Stoics or ascetics or whatever. People down through history said we just need to get rid of all desire out of our heart. Well, we wouldn't build anything. We wouldn't make anything. I mean, the whole energy, the creative force flows out of desire. It's not wrong to desire. It's wrong to desire wrongly. And it's not wrong to be jealous over your wife or your children or your husband because they belong to you in a certain way. And if someone, you know, steps in, I have a friend who has an aunt that's always telling her what she should do. It drives me crazy. I mean, this woman's a grown woman, and she's got this elderly aunt, and this woman can't say no to her. I think you should go do this, go do this. This woman is just running ragged, trying to keep up with what this elderly aunt's telling her she ought to do. And I just want to get up and say, smack her in the nose, you know. Tell her to mind her own business. Back up. It's not her life. Because this woman and her family suffers because she is led around by the nose by this elderly aunt, who thinks that she has God's wisdom on what everybody else ought to do. I mean, you know, one of the huge issues in our culture today, it's terrible in the church, is control. It's like, everybody thinks what somebody else ought to do. Well, fine, think what they ought to do, but don't try to control people and make them do what they ought to do. God doesn't. It's God who has the right to tell us what we should do or don't do. And when somebody else steps in and does that, they're sort of assuming God's role. Well, it says for his own good. Okay. And when you were that age, you always did whatever your parents told you, right? You never made your own decisions, made your own mistakes. And when you were that age and someone said, you must do this, you said, oh, yes, sir. That's exactly what I will do. I will never do anything but other than what you tell me, sir. Yes, sir. Because I enjoy being the son of the great Santini. Of course, what I do on his grave won't pass for flowers. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and sacrifice to their gods, and someone invites you to eat of his sacrifice, and take some of his daughters for your sons, and daughters play harlot with their gods, and cause your sons also to play the harlot with their gods, and you shall make for yourself no molten gods. So God agrees to make covenant with them with specifications. He will do miracles, which he has not done for other people. The Israelites must be particularly obedient and responsive. Then God will drive out the Canaanites before them. He will give the Israelites the Canaanite lands. Israel must utterly eradicate the Canaanites and their practices. Their altars must be torn down, their pagan worship ended, or else the people will be seduced away from God by it. You know, this issue of coming into Israel and pushing whoever's there out so that the people of God can come in there, that's been going on a long time. Mm-hmm. And right now, for instance, we have a whole lot of brouhaha about the Palestinians and the various people that were pushed out in 48, or getting pushed out of the land of Israel, as if somehow or another they're being mistreated. But we have to remember that it was they who came in and pushed out the Israelites. The Palestinians. As Israel began to be hauled off and all this stuff into captivity, in every age, including in the modern age, there were Palestinian peoples that moved into their space. Okay? So what's happening is God says, you know, okay, it's time for you all to move. And they go, well, you know, there's no God but Allah. And so God says, well, then I'll move you. And so what does he do? He sends Israel to move them. So, and then we get all upset because these Palestinians, you know, one of the things people have to remember is that the Palestinians, who are sort of the lineal descendants of Yasser Arafat, have no homeland, not because the Jews won't give them one, but because the other Arabs won't give them one. Because the other Arabs pushed them out of their lands. Lebanon, which was one of the most Christian Middle Eastern nations, invited Yasser Arafat and his people, the Palestinian people, invited them to come and live in their land out of the kindness of their hearts. And Yasser Arafat and his people, and who are wicked and evil people, he's dead, of course. Not dead enough, but he's dead. He betrayed those people and slaughtered them and just destroyed Lebanon. Just destroyed it. Beirut used to be the Monaco of the Middle East. It destroyed it all, wiped out all the Christians who were there, and basically, finally, the Christians rose up and pushed them out of Lebanon. Now, Jordan had already pushed them out. Saudi Arabia had already pushed them out. None of them will take them. And so, you know, they're saying, well, let's push them over to where Israel is, because none of us have, you know, let's do that. So the people want to complain about how these people have, you know, and to be fair, the little Palestinian boy or girl who lives in that village, you know, there, who's being pushed around, the shells are coming in, they had nothing to do with this. This has to do with political things that happened before they were born, over their head, and beyond their control. But the, you know, we it is the wrong thing to use our children as hostages in order to try to control do our evil. So I was up in northeastern Israel in a kibbutz up there, and the fence line.
What is a kibbutz?
A kibbutz. It's a farm, a collective farm. And the fence line is 8 feet tall, the razor wire and whatever. And beyond the fence is Syria. And the Hezbollah live down the hill, within 200 yards. That's the Hezbollah live there. And there's these buildings down there. And on the top floor, they have places where offices, where people work. And on the bottom floor, they have nursery schools. And on the middle floor, the Hezbollah have other rocket launchers. And so they launch rockets into Israel, onto the kibbutz, knowing that if the Jews launch rockets back, they're going to wipe out that children's school on the top and the business thing on the bottom, and vice versa. And so the Israelis have to go down the hill and fight hand-to-hand to clear out the middle floor, so as not to kill all these children and business people, innocent people. So they construct their buildings in such a way as to use their populace as hostages.
Pretty cowardly.
Yeah, well, it's what it is they're trying to leverage the goodness in people's hearts against them. Israel must not make covenants or treaties. See, Israel must not covet the Canaanites. They must not intermarry or worship their gods, lest the Canaanites seduce Israel away from God. Specifically, Israel must not make molten images. God wants relationship, not ritual behavior. Verse 18, you shall observe the feast of the unleavened bread. For 7 days you are to eat unleavened bread as I commanded you at the appointed time in the month of Abib, for in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt. The month of Abib became the first month of the Israeli calendar. It was later, the name was changed to Nisan. Abib became Nisan. But on the 14th of Abib was the Passover, and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread went from that for 7 days. The first offspring of every room belongs to me, and all your male livestock, first of your male livestock, first offspring of the cattle and the sheep. That's tithing. It's the first fruits belong to me. That goes all the way back to the garden, by the way. You shall redeem with a lamb the first offspring from a donkey. You shall, if you not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. You shall redeem all the firstborn of your sons, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. So the way you redeem your sons is by giving your tithe. That's how you buy back your sons, so that you may use them. Remember that God said all the way back in the beginning that the firstborn belonged to Him, firstborn sons. And what happens here at this particular point in time, we'll get into this later, is God said, as we go forward into the land, your firstborn belong to me. So therefore, they would be, by definition, the priests, and do all the things the priests have to do. They would have to be giving their life in service to the temple and to the priesthood. And that was difficult for many people. That wreaked a hardship on many people. First of all, they might only have one son. So then who is going to do all that family work, etc., etc.? They might have no son. They might have, their firstborn son might be the only one in the bunch that could manage anything. And so what happens is God said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you back your firstborn sons, and I'm going to take the tribe of Levi instead. And what I'm going to do is, Levi shall represent me. They shall be my priests and do all this work of the ministry in place of your firstborns. Now, the way you're going to redeem your firstborns is to take one-tenth of all of your goods and give it to the Levites so they can live. That's the basis of the tithe, the first tithe. One-tenth of all your goods and services you will give to the Levites so that they won't be able to make a living, because they're going to be doing the work of the ministry and they will not have time. I'm not going to give them land in Israel like I did all the other tribes. I'm going to scatter them out among Israel, so there'll be Levites in every town. Now, a Levite who manages his money can go out and buy a field if he wants to and do a vineyard or something. But historically speaking, it's believed that John the Baptist's father, Zachary, was a vintner. If you go to the place in Israel where, at the bottom of the hill, Jerusalem, there where they believe is the home of John the Baptist, you'll see that. But so you can do that. So the point, though, is that the tithe is the way you redeem back your firstborn, which belongs to me. So you think about your own family, and you say, okay, my firstborn child, let's assume that firstborn child is somebody you value. So make that assumption. My firstborn son, all right, he belongs to the Lord. He doesn't get to go work in a career. He doesn't get to do a whole lot of things. What he needs to do instead is perform the ministry in his community. And you know, it's like the Lord said, it's going to be better for all of us if I just appoint a ministry and then you finance them with your tithe. And that way what will happen is that you will have redeemed your firstborn back so that they can then function as the firstborn in your family should. So that's where this all comes from. Israel will observe the Feast of the Unleavened Bread to teach themselves and their children relational purity. The firstborn of man, his beast, is dedicated to God, must be redeemed back from him at a price. This is a universal and irrevocable law. You shall work 6 days, but on the seventh day you shall rest, even during plowing time. And harvest you shall rest, and you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks, that is the first fruits of the wheat harvest. Feast of Ingathering at the turn of the year. 3 times a year all your males shall appear before the Lord God of Israel. That's Passover, Weeks, and Pentecost. Passover and Pentecost, which are 50 days apart, and the Weeks, which is in the seventh month. Tabernacles, harvest. There's two harvests in Israel, the early harvest and the late harvest. And the early harvest happens around the time of Passover, and the late harvest happens in the seventh month. For I will drive out nations before you and enlarge your borders, and no man shall covet your land. When you go up three times a year to appear before the Lord your God, you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with the leavened bread, nor is the sacrifice of the feast of Passover left over until morning. You shall bring the very first fruits of all your soil into the house of the Lord your God. You shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. All right. Israel must honor the Sabbath as an acknowledgement of God's preeminence. It also provides them with a way to rest and contemplate on a regular basis who they are, who their family is, who God is. It's a way for people to have a family and not be worked out of their gourd. Three times each year, the men must go up to worship, that is, Passover weeks and in gathering. And if they do this faithfully, no one can take their land from them. You shall not offer blood with the leavened bread. You shall not allow the Passover lamb to remain until morning. All of these things are help them remind them about the trip out of Egypt and being set free as slaves, all that sort of thing. You shall not boil a kid its mother's milk, and the first fruits of your crops are to be given to God. I don't know why you're not supposed to boil a kid in his mother's milk. Someone's going to ask me.
Are they talking about a kid or a goat?
A goat. Yeah. You really didn't think that was a child you were talking about.
I wasn't.
Well, one of the weird things that they did back then is they didn't call children kids. There's nowhere in the Old Testament is a child called a kid. We're the ones that call him a kid.
Okay, I'm going to take us back to the tabernacle.
Yeah.
The fact that the word porpoise was in the Bible just blew me away.
Is that right?
Yeah. I couldn't believe that porpoise was... I mean, yeah, he made them, but I was... Every once in a while, I run across a word that's in the Bible, and it's like...
Well, let me help you with that, okay? The word is actually ha-kwa, okay? And the translator... The translator translated it porpoise. So, God didn't actually say porpoise. He said ha-kwa, okay?
There's another word that I found, and I wrote it down at home, and I can't remember it.
Well, it talked about grits, for instance.
And I was like, oh my gosh, this word is actually in here. The whole point of it just goes back to the detail that is in here.
Yeah, but you realize it's in the translation.
Right.
Yeah. So we're the ones who call it porpoise, you know. Mm-hmm. And that the word porpoise doesn't come from the Hebrew. It comes from some later language. So, and grits, etc.
Redeem it, then you shall break its neck.
That's right, because it belongs to me. In other words, you can't keep it.
Oh, you just can't keep it.
You can't keep it.
It's that complete dedication.
Yeah, what he's saying is if you don't redeem it, you can't keep it.
Oh, okay.
So, I'll put it.
So literal. I know.
Well, okay, that's fair. Verse 20 says if you don't redeem the donkey, you're going to have to break its neck. Well, how many times have you told your children you're going to break their neck, but you never really intended to, right?
A lot.
That's biblical. Huh?
Yeah. Well, so you got to remember that there's a, when we look at this stuff and we read it this literally, we would never hold ourselves to the same standard. You know, I'm going to kick you from here to Shinola, you know. Well, no one really expects that you could kick a child that far, right? We use phrases all the time. The word kid here actually means the offspring of a goat. Yeah, we don't call our children kids.
I can remember crying a big long cry when my daddy introduced me as, yeah, this is my kid.
Yeah. It's a sensitive beast, yeah. Yeah. Alrighty. Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these words, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and Israel. So he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He did not eat bread or drink water. He wrote on the tablets for the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. It came about when Moses was coming down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of testimony were his hands as he was coming down the mountain, that Moses did not show the skin of his face, did not know that the skin of his face shone because of his speaking with him. So his being with God for 40 days and 40 nights caused his face to have an aura about it that was frightening to people. So when Aaron and all the sons of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Then Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers of the congregation returned to him. Moses spoke to them, and afterward all the sons of Israel came near and commanded them to do everything the Lord had spoken to him on Mount Sinai. When Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would take off the veil until he came out. And when he came out and spoke with the sons of Israel, and he commanded the sons of Israel to see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone. So Moses replaced the veil over his face until he went in to speak with him. In Hebrews, we get a little insight into this. It says that one of the reasons that Moses put the veil over his face is because he did not want the people to see the fading glory. In other words, when he would go in to speak with God, he would come out and he had gravitas. Whatever. And so they said, you know, you're scaring us and whatever. So he wore this. But it said Moses also wore it because as he was longer and longer from talking with the Lord, that glory would fade. And he didn't want the people to see the fading glory. In other words, he wanted them to think he was that way all the time. That he had that gravitas all the time. You know, in the movie Ten Commandments, they show Moses with his hair all back and it's got streaks and highlights in it and whatever. Yeah. Starring Steve Reeves as a handsome windblown driver. It's in 2 Corinthians is where I did this. If the ministry, 2 Corinthians 3:7, if the ministry of death and letters engraved on stones came with glory, so the sons of Israel could not look intently on the face of Moses because of the glory of his face fading as it was. So if the ministry of the Old Testament came with glory, how shall the ministry of the Spirit fail to be even with more glory? For if the ministry of condemnation has glory, much more does the ministry of the righteous abound in glory. For indeed, what had glory in this case had no glory on account of the glory that surpasses it. For that which fades away was with glory, much more that remains in glory. Having therefore such a hope, we use great boldness in our speech, and are not as Moses, who used to put a veil over his face, the sons of Israel might not look intently at the end of what was fading away. But their minds were hardened, for until this day, at the reading of the Old Covenant, the same veil remains unlifted, because it is removed in Christ. To this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their heart. Whenever a man turns to the Lord, that veil is taken away. He's talking about Revelation. When, if you talk to the average person on the street who has no knowledge of God, doesn't know the things of God, and if you tell them the things about God that are precious to you, they'll think you're nuts. They won't honor that. They'll say, you know, I like that guy, but he's strange. He's got these strange beliefs. Yeah, that just doesn't make any sense. You know, like turn the other cheek and all that. You know, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. You know, giving his money to the poor, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's admirable, but, you know, it's also foolish. But if you're relating to people who have a sense of who God is, they see God in it. So what happens is the average person in the culture who's not walking with the Lord, when they see or hear our behavior to the degree that it is godly, they have a veil over their face. We have a veil over our face. They can't see it. The glory of it is hidden from them. The rationale of it is hidden from them. Why you would do that. Why you would want to. But if the veil is pulled back and they see this eminent glory of God in our lives, it will draw them to us. It'll make them stop and listen and think. And one of the things that, you know, a good way to make this sort of a... There are people that you can get around and they have a spiritual gravitas about them, and it just makes you want to be better, behave better. I bet you if Billy Graham were to come and teach our Sunday school class on a, say on a regular basis or whatever, that people would listen very intently, and they would listen to what he had to say, and they would believe what he had to say. And if you went up and talked to him afterwards, you would just be so pleased to shake his hand and whatever. You would treat him as if he were someone special. He's just William Graham. That's all he is. But he's got this gravitas. He's got this glory that emanates from him based upon his closeness to this walk with the Lord. Now, that's been true in my life with many people. There are people in my life who I know that walk very closely with the Lord, and when I'm with them, I sense the glory of God in them. Imagine if we were... Charles is one. Charles Mully is one of those people. Charles and Esther, they're two human beings. They're very, very human. But when you're with them, you know, we were able to go vacation with them, whatever. When you're with them, they just have a gravitas about them. And it's not something they're putting on. It's just... emanates from them because they are so simplistically dedicated to God. It emanates from them because the presence of God is so much richer in them. We as a people are meant to be more and more like that. Now, among ourselves, you know, we're who we are. But if we were to come get among people who don't know the Lord at all, and if their heart were opened to the Lord, they might think of us as some pretty good people. They might say, "Well, that person is a really godly man." I mean, I've actually heard people say that. Unbelievers who don't know the Lord or anything about the Lord, but they'll describe somebody I know, some person like us, or, you know, they'll say, you know, that Margie, she is a godly woman. You know, or Bob, he's a godly man. Well, I know Bob. And he is godly, but he's not, you know, I mean, I'm just being teasing, but he is godly, but he's sort of normative in our group. But to someone who comes from another place where they don't know the Lord, and if their heart is to know the Lord, and they go, okay, you know, look, he's gentle. He never fusses or fights, screams at anybody. He'll help you at the drop of a hat. You know, he's got a lot of love for his family. He's faithful to his wife. He's honest as the day is long. And those are things that we sort of take for granted. You ought to be. And if you are, then so what? You're only what you should be. But I promise you that when someone from the world who's been living in the streets, and I mean the streets, I don't mean under a bridge, but living in the culture out there, when they, especially like in that moment of awakeness, when they suddenly realize that they need God, but they've never had God, and they get around people, they'll say, "Man, I like that Bob because he's so different. He must be a saint." Well, ask his wife.
I was going to say, the people in your immediate family see all your flaws, mm-hmm. and it's harder for them to recognize how the extent of your godliness, it's harder for them to recognize it than it is somebody on the outside.
Yeah, a prophet's not without honor except in his own home. Yeah. But that's a decision we make. One of the things that that I consider to be one of the blessings in my life is that my children look up to me and my grandchildren look up to me and their mother as people of God. Now, every one of them heard me get upset and all that sort of thing, and, you know, Nancy doesn't do anything bad. But at any rate, the point is that they've seen our flaws, but on the main, they would say, you know, my grandfather, my grandmother, my mother and father, they're godly people. For instance, they might say that differently than someone whose father's a drunk and mother's run off with somebody. Okay? So just on that comparison. Or they might say that differently than someone whose father and mother are not grossly evil, but just have no spiritual depth whatsoever in their life, and there's no happiness and no joy or whatever. They might say, you know, your parents are they're really neat people. My parents aren't like that. And what they're seeing is this sort of level of God's glory reflected in us as people. And so we don't think that counts for much, but it does. That's why I'm constantly praying that the Lord will cause the world who doesn't know God but knows us to want to know God because they know us. They think of us as human, sure, but really good people. Now, they'll think that more if we allow ourselves to get sanctified. If we ask God to sanctify us and make us better and better and better. I'll give you an example. We drove up to LJ for a wedding this weekend. And we got all the way to LJ and realized that we hadn't brought the breathing machine. Now, that represents a problem for me, because I have a paralyzed diaphragm, and I said, well, I can just not sleep, you know, for the next 24 hours, and that'll whatever. We decided that wasn't going to work out real well. So we got in the car, and I told Nancy, I'll go get it. She said, no, I'll go get it. So we went together. So we drove all the way back an hour and a half, pick it up, and then drove back another 2 hours, because we came through the Apple Festival, and it cost us longer. So it took us 5 hours to get to LJ, which is an hour and a half trip. Now, I promise you that 10 years ago, that would have been a different scene. Because 10 years ago, I would have been fuming and fussing and angry, and I'd say, why didn't you remember that? And, you know, and she'd go, you know, okay, I'll go get it. Well, yeah, you go get it. You left it, you know, whatever. I would have been a nabob. A total yahoo about all of that, but what I felt about it was, it is what it is, and I'll just have. I thought I'd listen to some Georgia ball game on the way back, but Nancy went with me, so we worked crossword puzzles. We got so busy working crossword puzzles. We enjoyed traveling with each other. We got so busy we missed exit 14 and wound up coming over 53. It cost us a half hour in the Apple Festival. So the point, though, is that my natural response to that was not what it would have been 10 years ago, but my response was natural. If you want to see me at my worst, play bridge with me. Then you'll see me at my worst, because I can get really frustrated and angry around bridge, but that didn't bother me. It's just another 3.5 hour drive. It's not a big deal. And it wasn't that I put it on. It just didn't. It is what it is. And that's because of the work that Lord's done in me. Now, as you all know, He has a lot more to do in me. But the point is, I'm just using an example. You can look in your own life and you can see that there are some things now that you respond to better than you would have 10 years ago or whatever. And the reason is because God has worked in your life to make you respond differently than you would those many years ago. And if you will let Him, He will. If you will encourage the Holy Spirit, He will make more things like that. Or you can say, don't need you, God, and you will respond worse than you did 10 years ago. As you start, because we're either coming closer to God or farther from God at every minute. You know, we're not really standing still. Wesley said that salvation is a journey, and in the first part of the journey, you're climbing up a huge cliff, straight up a wall. And when you kind of come to know the Lord, then you have reached the summit of the cliff. And He said, but if you camp there, it doesn't take you much to back off the cliff and fall. So you need to journey inward from the edge of the cliff. That's the sanctification process. You journey inward so that if you have to make a back step, you're safe. You've got, you're not going to be going off the cliff. And so that's the Jeff Dininger had a beautiful word for his brother and his new bride. And it was, in fact, I wrote him, I said, I'm going to steal it. I need you to get, send a copy of it. But he said, you are not getting married today. You're becoming married. It was wonderful. He said, you're becoming married because marriage is a process. And your whole life you're going to be becoming married. You're being more and more married as you go along. It's not like we all got, we got married in a fever hotter than a pepper sprout. We've been talking about Jackson ever since the fire went out. You know, that's that whole thing about, I got this moment of salvation. It's a journey. And marriage, marriage is a journey. And we get closer and closer and closer to being married as we go on through time. That's why it's so hard for people like Connie to lose Bob. Yeah. Because she's lost such a huge... When Ben died, people would come up, our 17-year-old son, people would come up and say, that must be the worst possible thing. I said, no. It's the worst possible thing would be for me to lose Nancy. And I don't know how many people would say to me, not in my house. The worst possible thing for me would be to lose my child. And some of them who were friends, I'd say, well, that tells me a lot about your marriage. Because as much as it is painful to lose your 17-year-old son, and I will just assume it's more painful for Nancy than it was for me, but it was plenty painful for me. For us to lose each other would be a far greater loss by a good deal than for us for when we lost Ben. We know that. And one of the nice things about the terminal prostate cancer that I got, where they told me I wouldn't live past 09, was it made us live every day with a different attitude and spirit. And we still do today. Yes?
Oh.
Yeah. Well, our relationship, I would say that your marriage relationship grows. It's a covenantal relationship and it grows. And remember we talked about the fact when we were talking about how God built us in marriage is that we all start off with a desire for each other physically. And without that, we wouldn't come together. I promise you, if there was no physical desire in men, there'd be no children, you have to pay to have it done. So the point is that because we start off desiring one another physically, God designed it that way. It's a good thing. But as God gave us that desire to teach us intimacy, and intimacy is something you learn over a period of time. And as your marriage goes forward, what happens is you get to this place where the intimacy is more important than the physicality. And that even if the physicality disappears, because it can, or it can diminish or whatever, the intimacy grows to where, like I've told people before, the most intimate scene in the movie The Titanic was not the two kids, heating up the buggy in the belly of the ship. It was the old couple holding each other in the bed waiting for the water to come. That was the romantic scene. They would not be separated from each other, and so they just held on to each other waiting for the water to come. Because they wouldn't be separated. Now that's romance. What the kids were doing was romantic at a level, but a very base level. I mean, they loved each other, they cared for each other at some level. But the romantic scene was the old couple in the bed. Right? So. Say what?
I don't remember the kids in the bottom of the boat. I do remember.
Yeah.
I don't. But I do remember...
They got into an old car that was stored in the bottom of the boat and steamed up the windows, whatever. At any rate...
Another scene, but this one was... And the old couple was...
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and that's because God wants us to learn... See, God has so many lessons for us that are not evident at the beginning of the lesson. Yes, brother?
Did God's relationship with Moses improved over time.
Yes. The God's relationship.
I remember right, the first time he went up the mountain, it was really difficult. You could not look from God's face.
Yes. Raymond's asking, did God's relationship with Moses improve over time? And the answer is yes. First of all, the first one was when he met at the burning bush, and Moses didn't even want to do the things that he wanted him to do, and he was afraid of him and whatever. By the time we get to Sinai the first time, Moses is bargaining for the people's lives. So they've improved that much just from there to there, right? You know, at the burning bush, Moses is going, you know, send somebody else. My brother can speak better than I can. You know, don't send me. And God gets angry with Moses and said, look, I want you to go. Get over it. That argument's over. I mean, after God tries to pick up the stick, stick your hand in there. He tries to cajole him. And when he doesn't, God says, you're going. Okay, all right, okay. But by the time we get to the first trip up the mountain, at least when God is, and you're right, what you said is true. Moses could not look upon God much at all. But after they got to know each other over time, Moses said, I would like to be able to see you. Right? And then God hit him in the cleft of the rock and passed by so that he could see the back of him, because to see him face to face would destroy him. But you're right. And then by the time we get to the end of that relationship here at the waters banks of the Jordan, actually up on Mount Pisgah after this, God is telling Joshua that Moses is telling Joshua that because of his sin, that God will not let him enter into the land. But he's not saying it like bitter, like he just said, you know, I messed up, and so God's told me. But he said he's let me look into the land and see as far as I can see on top of Pisgah, Mount Pisgah, right? So, yeah, their relationship by the time we get to the end of the life is very, it's kind of like an old couple in a way. You know, it's very loving and accepting and philosophical, and just to be with him. Because you got to remember what's happening. Moses is getting ready to go to Sheol. He and God are not going to be able to fellowship again for a long, long time. On the other side of that equation, there's no conscious moment in the grave, so he's going to go to sleep and wake up. But their relationship developed.
Well, it seemed to imply that when it said, when Moses went before the Lord, it said that several times.
Yeah. Yes.
It appeared to me that it had become easier.
Yes, you're correct. I would read that the same way, that the longer they got to know each other, the easier it was. Well, I mean, it's like, you know, we all know what it's like for a wife to bargain with a husband over killing her child. Okay, I'm going to kill him. No, we all know what that's like. I'm going to put him out in the yard and not let him in for a month. No, you know, whatever. And Moses got to where he was bargaining with God for the sake of the people. Remember, one time God said, I'm gonna wipe them all out and start over. You know, I'm going to get you a honey, and we're going to be Adam and Eve again, all over again. We're going to start over. Well, how'd you think it was going to happen? Yeah, that's right. They all think they should just appear. Open up the microwave, and out they pop. Okay, somebody pray us out.